Blog Talk Radio.
Shalom, this is Richard Address, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome you to today's installment of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio. These shows represent our desire to explore issues and events that help shape and comment on the current revolution in longevity and how that revolution is impacting our families, ourselves, and our Jewish world at large. We invite you to share comments and ideas with us at rabbiaddress@jewishsacredaging.com or on our Jewish Sacred Aging Radio Facebook page. If you'd like to be a part of our conversation, we invite you to jot down this phone number and call in. Our producer, Steve, will be happy to greet you and place you in the queue. And that number is 646-668-8763. That's 646-668-8763. And now let me welcome to the Jewish Sacred Aging Radio microphone, Jeff Garson, who is in charge of a community called Radical Decency. Jeff, welcome. Welcome to the show. Nice to see you.
Well, I'm so grateful to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
So Radical Decency, this is a rather interesting concept. What is it? On one of the regular blogs that you send out, you say it's something that was created to answer the question, living in an endemically indecent world, how can we create better lives and meaningfully contribute to a better world? Translate that into Philadelphian.
Give you a little fuller background.
Yeah. What does that mean?
So where I begin my thinking is to say that we actually live in a highly valued world. And the values that are predominant are perfectly good values, but they're wildly, wildly overstated. And I summarize those values as compete and win, dominate and control. And it starts in grade school and right through college and into our careers. You know, get ahead, make more money, succeed. And that's the relentless message of the culture.
And so what's wrong with that?
Well, I say something bold at that point. It's created a failed culture. Because if you wanted to create a culture from scratch, you'd want it to do at least one of three things. You'd either want it to support us in being decent to ourselves, or being decent to others, or being decent to the world. And what's so sad and extraordinary, I think, about the world as it exists is the culture doesn't support us in doing any of those things. And I can elaborate on that if you'd like.
But so you maintain this, and then you created this. It's a program, it's a website, it's a what?
Well, I call it an approach to living.
Okay, so Radical Decency, and your focus is going to try to get people to do what?
Live by an alternative set of values, which to me makes a lot more sense.
So let's jump to, we talk about our generation, the baby boom generation, and who, you know, came of age in a rather radical cultural environment in the 60s and 70s,
right,
where a lot of these compete, win, dominate, succeed values were seemingly challenged. Okay. And some of us remember marching or writing or demonstrating around these values. What happened? Did we sell out?
Well, first of all, that's me also.
Okay.
I'm a baby boomer, and I marched for civil rights in the 60s. I was there when Martin Luther King gave his I Have a Dream speech.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So I'm very much a part of that. And what I take from that period of my life is that I was given a lovely message, which turned out not to be true, because there were these inspiring figures who acted with dignity and thoughtfulness who seemed to be able to change the world. And they did. In some significant ways. But it turns out 50 years later, I'm thinking changing the world is a lot more complicated than we were led to believe
like healthcare
back then.
Like healthcare. It's a little bit more complicated.
Exactly. So in a way, I may reflect others in your audience that that idealism is still with me. But after 40 or 50 years of thinking about, well, now how do you actually do that? I've done a lot of thinking and a lot of evolving. And I've arrived at this values-based approach to change.
What was the trigger for that? When you say you've done a lot of thinking and evolving, was there something in your life that sort of like was a pivotal point that made you say, aha, was it an aha moment somewhere?
Well, there was way down the line, 40 years later. But the lead up to that was doing a lot of things. I worked on political campaigns. I started nonprofits. I experimented with a lot of things which were useful and I think valuable. But they always seemed like puffs of smoke, you know? I worked against police brutality in Philadelphia in the late 70s, and we did good work. But then that issue kind of slid into the background. It didn't disappear. And it was just one other thing. And you look and you can find 15, 20, 100 things that need to be improved. When I hit upon this values-based approach, I thought, well, this is an organizing concept. If we think that we're all of us, we're trying to make the world better, that we're all promoting a common set of values, then we're united.
How do you do this with radical decency? You have the blog. What's the blog? What's the website?
Well, the blog that I put out is just called Radical Decency Reflections.
And someone wants to get a hold of it. How do they do that?
Well, they can sign up for it by going to radicaldecency.com, and then they'll get it every week, or go to thedecencygroup.com, which is the consulting group that I run that expresses these values.
Okay, so how do you translate what you've written in the blog into the world?
Well, in my writing, what I do is I take the values. And by the way, decency is a plug term. And for me, decency resolves itself into respect, understanding, empathy, acceptance, appreciation, fairness, and justice. And so my writing is all about saying, okay, if we're trying to live out of these values, how do we do that in the way we treat ourselves? Because decency to self is very important. How do we do it with friends and family? How do we do it at work? How do we do it in our communal interactions? So.
And what I'm just trying to struggle with this. How would you relate this now to just our generation and our own aging? I mean, we, as you said, you did the marches, mm-hmm. you were at the I Have a Dream. You lived your life. You went through some transitions.
Mm-hmm.
You're writing this out. Is there a sense of baby boomers then of saying, you know, we tried this, but the culture of, as you say, compete, win, dominate, succeed is just so overwhelming in America mm-hmm. that we sort of like flowed into that and we lost our idealism? Because I know, and we'll be talking to someone later on, that sense of idealism that you're expressing and our guest this morning also, there's a part of us that still has that idealism.
No, I don't think you have to lose it at all. I do think that these values, the predominant values, do seep into our lives. A very smart teacher of mine said, we're all in the dirty bathtub, all of us. When I think about these seven values
mm-hmm.
and I go out into the world and I interact with somebody, you know, at the corner store, or I'm a psychotherapist
mm-hmm.
When I'm dealing with a client or when I'm dealing with my wife,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, every moment I can think about how can I do a better job at being respectful, understanding, empathetic, and so on.
So
I feel very noble. I feel like I'm living my values in every interaction and everything I do.
Well, you know, and speaking specifically, these are classic Jewish values and, you know,
absolutely.
From the tradition, Musar values, you know, these are classic ethical parameters within the Jewish community. So I guess I have to ask you, as a proponent of what you're calling radical decency and these seven values, how do you square this with what's going on now in the country? Because the values seem to be, we seem to have been given permission to do just the opposite of what you're talking about.
Well, I think that's true. But I mean, to use a somewhat hackneyed phrase, it's the best of times and the worst of times, because I think those values are very obvious in the things that you read about every day in the papers. On the other hand, I find that there are an extraordinary number of people who are groping toward the same kind of thing that I'm groping toward. And I find I'm very heartened by that. And I think most people just want to do the best they can. I think the world is populated with well-intentioned people. But we do get derailed because of this constant pressure, you know, to get a job, keep a job, make enough money, get by. Those pressures are very real. But I think underneath that, there's a tremendous wellspring of decency that can be tapped.
How do you justify, I mean, how do you square? This is one of the things that just fascinated me in the last couple of months. On one level, we're seeing the Charlottesville pictures mm-hmm. where, you know, neo-Nazis are marching around Charlottesville in front of a synagogue saying, you know, Jews will not replace us. At the height of everything contrary to what it seems that you're writing about. Then the very next week, you're seeing people from all walks of life swimming through, you know, polluted waters in Florida and in Houston and in Puerto Rico to help another person and knocking on doors. They didn't ask them, mm-hmm. did you vote Republican? Did you vote Democrat? Mm-hmm. You know, what's your views on this? They just said, you need help. I'm here to help you.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of like within a month, you saw this dichotomy of the American culture. How do we begin to deal with that?
Well, I'm an optimist, okay? And I draw on my psychotherapy work when I say this, but I think that we get derailed into what we call our fight or flight brain by this incredibly competitive culture we live in. And that spawns the kinds of perversions that you hear from the voices of neo-Nazis and so on. But I do think that fundamentally we are what I call affiliative beings. You know, all that really matters is other people.
Right.
And loving ourselves and others is really the essence of living a good life. So I think at the end of the day, we have the better of the argument. And when I say to somebody, even the CEO of a company, look, are you really happy? You know, does that Porsche outside your house in Scarsdale, New York, really make up for what's happening in your marriage and your relationship with your kids? You know, very often the answer is, well, when you put it that way, no, I do feel trapped. How could I survive without my, you know, $8 million a year income? But they will acknowledge that it's not the best way of living.
But what happens when, and I'm sure you've seen this, what happens when they say, yeah, it does. And that old bumper sticker from when we were, I haven't seen it in a while, you know, he who dies with the most toys wins. I'm sure you've run across it in your practice and in your conversations about this of saying, you know, something, this is the way it is. And so I'm just going to get as much as I can and enjoy as much as I, sort of like the book of Ecclesiastes, first 11 and a half chapters.
I do have to say as an aside, I'm a Jew by choice. I'm half Jewish. And a big part of my inspiration is when I realized that I was a Jew in the early 70s. So your comment about the tradition, I think the tradition says it better than I do.
Yeah, well, I'm kind of a fan of the tradition too. Yes, I am. But go ahead.
So, let me go back to your question. You can make that choice. And the toys are nice. There's no question about it. But you can make another choice also. And by the way, I'm not a bomb thrower. I'm not saying explode your life.
No, okay.
But what you can do is say, look, these values make more sense. They lead to a better life. So I can begin to push with persistence and focus and determination wherever I am in the world to do more of this and to encourage more of this coming back to me. And a CEO can do a lot of stuff without, you know, getting thrown out or, you know, losing his house in Scarsdale. To put more of these values into his life.
And by the way, there's nothing wrong with Scarsdale.
I grew up in Scarsdale,
so
which is probably why I
did. It's probably okay. Because I have some good friends in Scarsdale. They're really great people.
Right.
you write on one of your blogs about the shift in American culture with role models.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we were talking a little bit before. I just had this conversation with somebody last week at a synagogue about when we were growing up. Very powerful role models, not only politically, but, you know, in my own, in my rabbi that was my sponsor at the seminary, really very powerful. And you write that this has all changed, that there seems to be a real shift in role models, people that we want to identify with or model ourselves afterwards. Could you, you know, elaborate on, because we grew up with a lot of these overwhelmingly powerful figures, right, politically, familially, in many ways, academic, school people, but you seem to write in one of the recent blogs on, actually it's called The Not So Mysterious Absence of Disappearance of Public Role Models. What's going on here?
Well, it's disheartening, honestly, from my point of view. I mean, I think what's happened is it used to be the compete and win, dominate and control was implicit and operated below the surface and probably wasn't as predominant as it is today, let's say in 1960. The current president makes no bones about the fact that, you know, we're going to win, win, win. Well, that's a very explicit statement of something that probably John F. Kennedy felt, but didn't say. And he was infected by the kinds of values that I talk about a lot more than Donald Trump is. So I think that this progressive coarsening is a progressive sort of direct acknowledgement of these underlying values. And I think it's created such a coarse public dialogue that most of the good people stay out of it entirely. You know, who would want to run for office at this point? You know, because you're going to be attacked the moment you put yourself up. It's guaranteed. And you're going to be pushed very hard to attack back, mm-hmm, which of course is indecent also.
So, but the role model thing, for those of us, you know, we're getting older. What's the importance really of our generation seeing ourselves as role models, not only for society, but for our own family, children, grandchildren? Because I think there comes a point in many of our lives when we realize that this is one of the great things that we have an opportunity to do, but really model a type of behavior and living and value system, not necessarily for us, but for our children and grandchildren.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. I mean, you know, and I'm that generation. I'm 71 years old, and I'm very excited about these last 10, 15, 20 years of my life, because I kind of have it figured this way. My decline and death is going to be rivetedly important to my children and grandchildren. And if I do that well, and if I do that out of a sense of values, well, what greater gift is there to give to somebody? I mean, it's a really precious moment, I think, in my life where I can do something really, really important.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned something. I just read another article, and I actually just picked up the book by Erwin Yalom, his biography. And he, I think it's in a recent Atlantic Monthly, maybe last month's Atlantic, where they have a little column on him. And he's basically saying the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
He's in his mid-80s, I think, or late-80s. And he's consciously aware that his lifespan may be coming to a close, but he also is verbalizing the fact that one of the gifts that he can give is how he approaches his own death.
Right.
And maybe that goes with this, perhaps maybe one of the great lasting gifts of our generation, as we begin to age out, is how we die and how we approach, right, how we approach our own finity.
I couldn't agree more. I'll tell you a cute story about Erwin Yalom, who's a very well-known therapist.
Oh, yeah.
So I was at an event with 2,000 other therapists, and Yalom got up to speak at 88 and said, "I know why you're here." And he was right. Yeah. And he was giving his gift to us.
The this concept of change and the competitiveness of the culture, it is so difficult to counteract, isn't it? And even at our age, I was always struck when I was traveling and still travel, the impact of American culture on foreign cultures. I mean, landing first time when I was a kid in London and expecting to see, you know, the fantasies of British in there, and on riding on the tube is a Kentucky Fried Chicken. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, here or a McDonald's, American culture seems to be so pervasive. How do we begin to really react to or counter that desire for those concepts that you're talking about, competitiveness,
right?
You must win, you must dominate, you must succeed. Because I see in young people, especially high school students, it's one of the reasons why there's such a rise in cutting and youth suicide, the pressures that we put on these kids.
Yeah.
And so how does Radical Decency, your program, begin to, you know, focus in on countering that?
Well, first of all, it's inclusive. So, you know, the best people I know are fighting for a better environment or for a fairer shake for women and so on. And that work is important. I mean, that's, you know, I need to say that. What I'm offering isn't instead of, it's in addition to that. But I think that work is jump-started when we realize that there's a set of values that we not only bring to that work, but we bring to our families when we come home at night, how we talk to them, and how we do everything in our lives. So I think it ennobles that work, and it also brings us together. Because suddenly, if you say, well, we're all in a values fight, people who are working against hunger and people who are working on issues of aging realize, well, we're doing the same thing. And we need to learn from each other and support each other. And my dream for the world is that everybody, not just activists, people who are just civilians, will be thinking about these values and understand that we're doing the same thing, and that slowly we'll cohere into a much larger and more coherent force for change.
We have about 2 minutes left in this segment, and I want to just ask you to comment on one of the other blogs that you recently wrote about. Again, it goes back to role model changes and you know, who we look up to and how things have changed within the society in our lifetime. That has to do with boundaries, dealing with the role of women in society, equality, and the expectations that society may place on young women, girls in that transition. I think we see this as boomers because we've lived through the feminist revolution. We remember when it began, and we've tried to model certain things for our own daughters who are now moms,
right?
You know, and trying to raise. But the culture that you're talking about, no matter how hard we try, there's still an imprint from what you're writing about on this division, male, female.
Change is hard. I wish I had 10 hours to talk about this, because
you're about 2 minutes.
When you talk about gendered relationships, I think if we can change there, we're going to jumpstart change every place, because we're talking about the most important relationships for all of us. We're talking about a wife interacting with her husband, a father interacting with his daughters, parent and child. And that is a crucible where, boy, you're called to rights if you're not decent, as I understand it. And so I think the work there is just so important. And if we can do it there, it becomes so much easier to do it at work and in other relationships. And it's so subtle, and it's a reminder of how deep these values are. You know, when you come out of a movie theater and your wife says, well, I think it meant so-and-so. And I, as a man, say, oh no, that's not what it means. Do you hear compete and win, dominate and control? Do you hear how my native language is to say, you're wrong. Let me tell you what it means. It's that subtle. And I could give you 10 examples like that. So, yeah, absolutely. It's a great example of where really important social change work can happen right in our most important relationships.
So Radical Decency, a community that you've created and practice. And again, somebody wants to tap into this. How do they do this?
Go to thedecencygroup.com. Sign up for the blog. I send that out every week. I also do a webcast every Monday night where I talk with a group of people that have raised their hands and say, we want to discuss your weekly reflection in greater depth. And we love to have people join us because we believe passionately in what we're doing.
Jeff, Jeff Carson, thank you very much for being a guest here on Jewish Sacred Aging Radio. I appreciate it. Continued good luck. Say hello to the family and have a good year and much success in what you're doing.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
Turn your podcasting passion into profits. The book, The Business of Podcasting, describes the business side of podcasting, including how to become a professional podcaster. You'll learn about positioning your clients' expertise through podcasting, too, plus the best business models, how to find clients, and much more. Visit thebusinessofpodcasting.com.
What we hope to be a regular feature here on Jewish Sacred Aging Radio will be to invite commentaries from a broad range of contributors. And we welcome for that to our microphone, Stephanie Cohen, an author, writer, teacher, community activist, volunteer, and I guess equally as important for our conversation here right now, baby boomer mom of three young adult daughters. Knowing them, that's an interesting, I'm sure you'll get a comment from them on that.
Probably, yeah.
Anyway, thanks, Stephanie. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
One of the features that we're trying to do here on the show is to bring contributors who have a perspective on aging, on the role of growing older. And you really talked, well, modeled a lot about the, speaking of role models, about the transitions and moving from career. You started in one career and then a few years ago, you decided maybe we'll do something else because it's a certain calling. I think you refer to it as a calling. So talk to me a little bit about this calling and your perception. We just had this conversation with Jeff about the power and importance of role models, and you're a role model of exactly what we're talking about, of independence and following your calling and following your passion and moving from one position to another. Talk to me about that.
Well, it's actually really complimentary to hear you refer to me as a role model. I'm not sure that's how I
no,
think
you
of
are,
the transitions.
You are. No, you but, are. You are. You are. You are.
You know, I've certainly been very fortunate in my life that I've had a few different careers, all of which have been very satisfying and good for the period of time in which I worked on them. And as you mentioned, I've made some transitions from one role to the next. About 17 years ago, I decided to take a break from my corporate experience and to focus on my writing and my parenting responsibilities. And that turned out really well. I enjoyed it very much. I had a lot of support in doing it. But the more I did it, the more I focused on my writing, the more I focused on my community involvement, the more I realized that what I was really doing, in fact, was discovering what I referred to as my calling, my real passion, which is connecting with other people. And so while I pursued my writing and I pursued teaching of writing and I pursued lots of great volunteer opportunities like working with Samaritan Hospice, what I was really doing was identifying opportunities to connect with other people. And that was my mission.
And you write a lot. I mean, one of the things we've published, I think one or two of your stories on JewishSacredAging.com, which have gotten really wonderful responses. Talk to me about the power that you found in writing and putting that soul of yours on a piece of paper.
Well, I think I write to connect. I think that what all of us really want in life is to be seen for who we really are, to see ourselves as honestly as we can, and to be appreciated and understood, both for our strengths and also for our vulnerabilities. So I write to be able to share my own truth and to be able to connect with others through that sharing of truth. I write so that I'm seen and to connect what I think of as the wisps of our humanity from one person to the next so that we can all be seen.
Those connections, because I know, as you've mentioned, and I know those building of those relationship connections, those linkages, those wisps, which is a great word, by the way. There's a story in that. That really has defined you, hasn't it? I mean, that you are a relationship connector, if I can coin a phrase. I guess I just did. The power of relationships to you, and not only your writing and your volunteer work, I'm sure that comes to you because you do vigils for Samaritan, right? You help people, you walk people through those last stages of life. And as we were alluding to before with Jeff, that perhaps, and we will with our next guest too, that is, it's a gift. It's a gift. Talk to me a little bit about how that influences your own writing, your own neshama, your own soul when you accompany somebody in that last stage.
Well, the best thing we can do for one another is to show up. And I think for most people, if not for everybody, approaching the end of someone's life or the end of the life of their loved one is one of the most powerful, painful, truthful moments that individuals experience. And those moments have to be honored, and they have to be witnessed, and they have to be respected and treated with a tremendous amount of compassion and love. So I feel that if we can bring that witnessing and that honoring to moments in people's lives, particularly moments of transition, whether it's a life into death transition or any other significant transition in someone's life, that's the gift that we bring. That's our humanity showing up to meet someone else's humanity.
Stephanie, what's the power of love?
It's everything.
The
power of love is that we recognize that in each individual person, there is a grain of truth. There is a grain of humanity. If this is comfortable for people, there's a grain of God.
Mm-hmm.
And when we bring those grains together, when we recognize them in one another, that connectedness, that is love.
There's a Bialik poem. He's one of the great modern Hebrew poets. That talks about this. He calls it this zikmutza, this light that shines, the divine light of alluding to in the tradition that shines within each individual, and the challenge of finding that. But that's what you do, don't you? I mean, that's what you try to do. And in your transition from the work field into this different type, it's a different type of work, but it's a spiritual work. How difficult was that transition to move out of the legal community and the marketing community into, I guess, for want of a better term, the spiritual community?
Not difficult.
Right.
It wasn't difficult at all. In fact, it's a huge relief to release some of the values that were taught that Jeff was speaking about.
Mm-hmm.
It's a huge relief to unburden oneself.
Wow. Talk about, just unpack that a little bit. I mean, you say that's an interesting use of the word relief, as if you're free. You free yourself.
That's right. Well, I think that we're taught so many things in society, and there are a lot of challenges, and there's no denying that.
Mm-hmm.
But the more we can focus on the inner authentic self, and the more we can recognize the humanity within other people, the more we can bring those moments of light together from one person to the next, the more we can live truly and live honestly and live, I think, as well as we can, to do the best that we can.
What are you writing now?
Well, I recently came to this recognition that the writing wasn't the goal in and of itself,
mm-hmm.
but that the writing is a tool for connectedness. So I'm teaching a little more. I teach a course called Telling Your Story, Writing from the Heart. And the goal there is to work with people to identify what it is that speaks to them individually, and encourage people to put those thoughts on the page. And in my own writing, I try to do the same thing. I find the moments that are most fragile, most vulnerable, and I exploit those on the page. That's what connects to other people.
So the connectivity and the wisp. So Stephanie Cohen, thank you very much. Just let me ask you one quick question in concluding for this little segment. There may be people who listen to this now live or on the podcast who are thinking about, gee, I'm finishing up this one career, or I've just been let go and I'm in a job, but I really don't like it. And I really wish I could do this, that, and the other thing. What's that? If they're sitting here in front of you and saying, gee, I'm really, you did it. I'm so concerned. I'm a little afraid to do it. It's a big risk. What's the advice that you would give these people?
Well, the first thing I would say is, you're right, it's scary. And you're right, it can be challenging. It can be hard. But come from love, not fear, and pursue what you need to pursue by building relationships with other people, talking to other people who have shared interests. Trust your instincts. Rely on your support systems as much as you possibly can. And be truthful with yourself about what really matters to you.
It's a great sermon. Thank you. Very well done.
Thank you.
Very well done. Thank you. Continue good luck with everything. And I hope we'll see you back here on a somewhat regular basis because you said you would.
Looking forward to it.
And we'll try to keep you that. Stephanie Cohen, thank you very, very much. We'll be right back. Welcome back to our now final segment here on today's edition of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio. And we are pleased to welcome Ross Schriftman here to the microphone. Ross, thank you very much for being here. Welcome. Welcome to the microphone. Welcome to the show. And we're here to talk about a very, very interesting and exciting project that you're involved with, book and then a film that comes out of, again, this theme of today. It seems to be of transitions and decency and values and love and heart. And certainly from what we've talked about, the motivating factor of what you're doing with the film comes directly from your heart and with a sense of love. So talk to me about, first of all, let's get right to the film. What's the film about and why?
Well, it's a film about my mom. It's called My Million Dollar Mom. Great to see you again, by the way. My mom had Alzheimer's, form of dementia, and she had it only for 2 years, which is actually a short time for many people. And she got it late in life. She got it when she was 82, and she died at 84. And so I was her primary caregiver for those 2 years. Of course, she cared for me for 57 years, so I think the ratio is pretty good in my favor.
Right. So your mom, the Alzheimer's, and by the way, the book that I'm holding is called My Million Dollar Mom, subtitled The Story of a Remarkable Life of an Ordinary Person, and it's published by Infinity, and you can get it through?
Well, you can go to my website.
Which is?
MyMillionDollarMom.com.
Okay.
And there's a link there to order the book, or you can email me from there, and I'll send you a signed copy.
Great. So again, My Million Dollar Mom, the story of a remarkable life of an ordinary person. So you took care of your mom, the Alzheimer's thing, the caregiving thing, which we'll get to in a minute. You wrote this book. Where'd the film come from?
Well, the film idea... as I was writing, late in my mother's life, the later stages of her Alzheimer's, I would sit in her TV film library room, and I'd make notes about her life. And that's kind of how the book went from a memoir to an actual book. When the book came out, I started thinking about, I'd be driving down the road, and a song would come on the radio, and I'd think about something that happened in her life. And I said, boy, that would be a great scene for a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of how it started. And I found out later that's many times the seed of somebody writing a script for a movie is just out for a walk or listening to the radio and hearing a song or having a memory.
So walk me through here, because there may be some people thinking about, gee, I would like to do that, but to me, that'd be something kind of overwhelming to put this on a screen. First of all, you have to write the script. Who did you write this script?
I did.
And you have to finance it. And so, I mean, you didn't just go to a kiddie bank and say, could I have a couple of dollars to, because I want to make a movie?
No, that doesn't really work that way. I did a lot of studying. I did a lot of research. I took a number of courses. I hired a script coach.
Wow.
And I try to option the film, and my last name is Schriftman, which actually means script man. So I call these Hollywood producers, and I talk to the assistant, and I said, tell Joe or tell Sally that Ross script man called. And, you know, Ross Schriftman, it's like script man.
Did it work?
I did get calls back.
Good.
But as time went by, the more I thought about it, and I got advice from other people, it's a passion of mine. And my concern was that if I sold the script, it's called optioning the script, they would make changes to it. And since it's such a personal situation, I wanted to really show people who my mother was, not only when she had Alzheimer's, but who she was before she had Alzheimer's, and how she really was the same person. Just that people need to understand that Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia is a brain disorder. The personality is deep still inside them. They are still who they are, and they still have their point of view. And I wanted to get that across in the film.
You raise an interesting point, because having done some work in that and working with the Alzheimer's Association here in greater Philadelphia, and having walked this walk a little bit with my own mom, the question always, not always, the question sometimes comes up, you know, that's not really my mom anymore. I go to see her and it's not really. And yet you just elucidated the fact that, on the contrary, that really is, that there's that spark. I mean, Stephanie was talking about that spark of the divine, that spark is still there, maybe in a different location.
Right.
Or,
yeah.
So could you just talk to me about how you felt when you walked that walk with your mom, and you would walk in to that room and your mom's body is there and she's alive. What was going through your mind? What was going through your soul?
Well, in the later stages, it's very hard because they're less, it's less communication. But occasionally there'd be these moments of joy when she would remember something or be clear. It's kind of like some of the mechanisms in the brain are still working. She would still sing the Friday night Sabbath candles. We would take her to synagogue, me and her caregiver, our wonderful Nora, early on, and she would sing the prayers in tune, but then you get to the parking lot and she'd try to get in on the driver's side. You know, she'd go in forwards instead of sitting. But there's certain parts of the brain that still work, and music is part of it. Love for animals. Her pets were a big part of who she was. The dog, the cat. She rescued animals from the Katrina rescue, from the Katrina hurricane. Mm-hmm. I still have her dog, mm-hmm. who's in the movie. Happy Girl is in the movie. Helen Keller, the blind cat's not in the movie, but she named her Helen Keller. But there's that spark that's still there, and to draw that out, and also as a caregiver, you've got to be comfortable with the fact that there are things that she cannot do anymore. And no matter how you try to instruct somebody, there's not that file in the brain anymore to instruct them in that. You just have to, live in their world as well as you can.
What was the greatest challenge of being her caregiver?
Getting the hardest part is when you're the son or the daughter and your parent has pretty much done what they wanted during their lifetime. All of a sudden you've got to kind of be the parent to your parent.
Mm-hmm.
And there's tremendous resistance. When I hired a caregiver, my mother, she ripped into me one night. You have no right to be telling me what to do. She can get another job. She was whispering because she didn't want to insult the person. She wanted to make sure the other person got a job, because that's how my mother was. She was very concerned about other people. She really did live tikkun olam.
In your caregiving, because the caregiving component, especially dealing with Alzheimer's, is so overwhelming. Was there ever a moment in your journey when you looked at this, or you may have visited mom or taken her there, taken her here or there, taking care of her, and you were getting back in your car or something to drive someplace or drive home, and this fear came to you of saying, is this going to be me in 30 years?
Actually, never.
Really?
I'm not afraid of getting dementia. In some respects, she wasn't in physical pain.
Mm-hmm.
It was upset, that kind of thing. I've never thought about it that way. We face all kinds of things in life. I think I have a greater fear. I had an uncle who had Parkinson's, and his mind was clear most of the time, but he couldn't move.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I would fear more of that than having dementia.
What's the biggest piece of advice you would give to somebody who may be listening, who is walking this walk right now, who's a caregiver for a loved one with Alzheimer's or dementia?
Make sure you have a good support system is number one. You're going to find out who your friends are, who's going to be helpful. And you're going to just appreciate the moments, the good moments. Take good care of yourself. It's very hard to get rest. And my mother, I lived still in the house that my parents bought years ago, and I cared for her at home.
Mm-hmm.
Try to think ahead. Plan if you can't. If you're in it already, it's hard to plan. But there's things that you should plan ahead of time. You should have that discussion, that conversation. One of the things we hope to do with our film is that people, after seeing the film, will have that conversation with their family members and make, you know, ask them how they want to be cared for, what's important to them. Make sure you have your legal documents, all of that in place. And also, don't feel so guilty. You can't do everything. Do the best you can. Make sure you get rest. Try to get some help. Home care isn't always going to work for everybody. And if it doesn't, try not to feel guilty if your loved one has to go to a nursing home or assisted living or other community, because you need the support. I was fortunate. My mother only had Alzheimer's. She didn't have other conditions that would have made it more difficult. Our biggest problem early on is she could outrun her age.
Mm-hmm.
She was 100 miles an hour because she was very active in life. She taught English as a second language. She was head of Soviet Jewry at her synagogue. She taught immigrants the citizenship tests. She started Buxmont Parents Without Partners. She was one of the founders. So when she got Alzheimer's and she was home, she was busy, busy, busy. And so it was a lot of cleaning up and following her around and trying to keep her safe was the biggest issue.
The film, how long did it take you to put this film together? Years, I would imagine.
It's my mother died 8 years ago. The book was published about a year after, and I've been working on the movie for about 5 or 6 years.
So you obviously had help in casting this, and I mean, it's just not something you've, or maybe it is, you just do on your own.
Well, I
never
hired,
having made a movie.
I hired some great people. I learned a lot over the last several years. Who is the right person for things? The director is a key person of the creative end.
Mm-hmm.
But there's another position called the line producer, and the line producer is the person, the glue that puts everybody together. What the cast is, who's going to be, what the schedule is, working with me on the locations, all of that. There's a lot of work to it. You also have to be, as an independent producer, you have to have four set skills. One, you have to be creative, the story that you want to tell. You have to know how to run a business, because there's a lot of business end to this thing, contracts, paying people, making sure that locations have their agreements, the technical end, how the camera works, how the lighting works, and then being able to market the film, not only when it comes out, but before, to get people to buy into being part of the project. So it's quite a passionate project, and it's a lot of stuff that I've learned.
So where are we now with the film?
We finished filming 2 weeks ago.
Uh-huh.
We have our second edit, which we were going over notes yesterday. We're working on possible music composer, and we hope to have it ready in the next couple months.
Okay, so we're doing this in the fall, and so you're anticipating sometime in winter of 2018 this will be ready to be shown?
Right.
And where do you take it? I mean, you just can't, well, maybe you can. Like the old days, come on over for dinner and we'll show you our home movie. So obviously this is a theatrical production, so where do you hope to debut it?
Yeah, the whole film industry is very different today because of digital and video on demand downloads and all kinds of different ways that people watch films.
Right.
It's not the same as it always was, although people still like to go to the theater. So we'll probably have a premiere. Local theaters have these premiere nights. It's a short film. It's about a 30-minute film. And there's two main areas we're working on, besides trying to get it into film festivals. And there's a lot of Jewish film festivals.
Right, all over the country.
And
right.
It has a Jewish theme. Tikkun Olam is very key to the film, of who my mother was and how she inspired me to live a life of helping other people one at a time. And that's kind of how Tikkun Olam works. There's two main efforts we're going to make. One is to have this available for community events for various organizations, whether it's Dementia Society, Alzheimer's, churches, synagogues, various community organizations. We're also forming an educational advisory committee of experts on dementia and planning. And we're putting together a study guide, and we're going to try to get it certified for continuing education for lawyers, insurance agents, financial planners, estate planners, caregiver groups.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to have a package with the film, the book, and the study guide, and go around and talk about this program.
Have you been in touch with the Alzheimer's Association?
Yeah, we've been working with them for a number of years. In fact, I'm on the Run to Remember committee for the Philadelphia Marathon coming up, which we raise money. We have about 100 runners coming up for that.
In this process between the book and the movie, what have you learned about yourself?
That I'm the same person I always was. And I'm very much like my mother. Lots of organizations, lots of activity, passion for various causes, whether it be animal rescue or certain illnesses that friends or family have had. So I found that my years of experience, both in business and with charitable work, and organizing like a regional president of the Reform Men's Clubs, that this has all come together. And it's a way for me to deal with a hole in my life of my mom being gone in a positive way, doing something in her memory. So that's the personal end, but also to raise awareness about this particular illness and what it does to people, and the fact that we don't have a cure yet, and the fact that people in many cases don't plan ahead because they don't want to admit they're going to have that problem. So it's both a personal benefit to me, and it's an outreach to other people to try to help them. And I've made so many friends. And we actually have, we had somebody in one of our scenes that actually has a younger onset Alzheimer's.
Mm-hmm.
Tom Brophy is an advocate, and he and his wife were in our bar mitzvah party flashback scene. So that was really good because he was able to help me with my film and we're taking our message to the public.
What's next after the film? What do you, I mean, is this an end in itself or do you see this as just another part of a process that's going to continue to unfold?
It's going to continue. We still want to do a feature film. So the 30-minute film, which I was able to pay for, bring everybody together and have this thing. Then we're going to go to the feature. I want to do another film about my mother's childhood and young adult time during the Depression and World War II. I had to cut that out of the movie because it would have been too long. It would have been an epic. And just continue doing that kind of work in the community.
It's important to tell the story, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
It makes me feel good.
Well, it's also, you know, in keeping with the tradition, it's a way to really bring honor to a person's memory.
Right.
And to allow your mom to continue to live on. And given the statistics of Alzheimer's that are expected in the next, you know, decade or so, two decades, as our generation ages out, you're speaking to an issue that's only going to continue to evolve and hit more and more and more people because of just the sheer numbers of people and the caregiving concerns, which is why the fact that you, as many people do, you know, you're the caregiver, you're the person who had to step up.
Yeah,
you know?
I want to make sure that people that are caregivers know how much they're appreciated and that they can get this through this too.
And so that last piece of advice before we're going to start running out of time here, what that last piece of advice for those caregivers, you talked about respite care, self-care, having the conversation. But in the end, you do it alone, don't you? You really, it's up to you, the individual to step up.
It is usually, one person is the primary. They may have a lot of support from other people. Sometimes there's no support at all. And that's a really hard thing.
Last question real fast. You have 15 seconds to answer this question. Easy question. How important was your faith in this?
Very important. I felt God was with me all through this.
Wow.
And she was with the God. My mother was there. And God was with my mom.
The name of the title of the film is what?
My Million Dollar Mom.
And the book is My Million Dollar Mom, the story of a remarkable life of an ordinary person. You can get the book for how?
Go to mymilliondollarmom.com.
And you'll take care of it from there.
Right.
We'll look forward to the debut of the film someplace. We're coming to you from southeastern Pennsylvania, southern New Jersey, but eventually, this will probably make its way through your website if people want to get a hold of it, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
Well,
yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Ross. Thank you very much. Continued good luck. Thank you, all of you, for being part of today's broadcast here on Jewish Sacred Aging Radio. These shows will be archived as podcasts on both the Blog Talk Radio and our website, www.jewishsacredaging.com. Again, we invite you to send your comments and suggestions to me, rabbiaddress@jewishsacredaging.com. or the Jewish Sacred Aging Radio Facebook page. These shows are produced at the studios of Lubetkin Global Media here in beautiful Cherry Hill, New Jersey. And with a special thank you to our producer, Steve Lubetkin. Thank you for listening. We look forward to greeting you again on the next edition of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio here on Blog Talk Radio. I am your host, Richard Address. Thank you and shalom.